Hey, folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. It's me, your host, Damian Mason, and I want you to sit back and enjoy this educational session because we're talking about fats and oils and we're talking about where all this stuff that you use every day comes from and how it happens. I've got Chris Peterson. He's the president of a company called Hero BX out of Erie, Pennsylvania. I lived there for 14 weeks in the summer of 1992 working for an oil absorbent company. So, I haven't talked to anybody ever on this show from Erie, Pennsylvania, but here we are. So, Chris Peterson, we're going to talk about your industry, which is pretty big, and it's kind of behind the scenes. Not a lot of people know what happens, but we know there's a soybean field, and we know there's a corn field, and then we know there's a thing called renewable diesel, biodiesel, ethanol. We're talking about sustainable aviation fuel. We're also talking about this entire thing out here. We talk about oil seeds. Where's all this go? How's it happen? You're going to be my expert on that today. So tell us about your company and what you do, and then let's talk bigger picture about the industry. And the reason, by the way, dear listener, we're covering this is because I'm going to be a speaker for the American Fats and Oils Association on October 13th in Savannah, Georgia for their national convention. So popular and such a big industry. In fact, they've closed registration for the convention already. So if you don't think it's a big industry, it's a big industry. Anyway, talk to me about your company and what this whole industry looks like.
Sure. My company is Hero BX, and specifically, we are a multi-state, multi-feedstock biodiesel producer. So we take feedstocks ranging anywhere from virgin vegetable oils like soybean oil or canola oil, and all the way down to rendered animal fats or recycled cooking oil or other waste greases. And we turn those into a fuel that is compatible with diesel fuel. It can be used as a transportation fuel. It can be used in off-road applications like farmers' tractors, or it can be used in home heating applications, specifically like in the Northeast and the New England states. They're still using oil heat up there.
Yeah, so I'm in Indiana. Here my farm is. There's three ethanol plants within about 30 miles here. There's mm-hmm. Poet, there's Central Indiana Ethanol, and there's another one. And to be honest with you, I can't remember the name of it right now. What's different about what you do there at your facility versus these ethanol plants? People sell their corn. Take your corn there, dump it, and then they turn it into ethanol. What do you do that's different than that?
Sure. What they're doing is they are utilizing starches and sugars in corn to ferment an alcohol that is then blended with gasoline. We take products that are oils, greases, lipids, triglycerides, and we specifically are mixing those triglycerides with an alcohol like a methanol or an ethanol, and we're creating a chemical reaction, making a methyl ester. One of the byproducts of that process is glycerin, which is then used as a feed ingredient. It's in the gel caps of, you know, the Tylenol that you're taking. It's in cosmetics. It's in soaps, detergents. So one of our byproducts or co-products is in something that, most people are using every day.
Okay. So that's the gel product that you just said, but that's not your main stuff. That's a byproduct. Correct. Main stuff. You're taking, by the way, you take in all this stuff. So where's it come from? I mean, you take the facility that processes soybeans. They talk about the crush. Explain that a little bit. Soybean crush and the meal and the oil and all that.
Yeah, sure. So
take me from the field of soybeans to end user.
Yeah, essentially what happens there is the farmer grows soybeans. The soybeans are harvested. They're taken to a processor. The main product or the main reason for crushing that soybean is for the meal, which is a protein. That protein is then sold largely into the animal feed industry. One of the resulting co-products or byproducts is the oil. That oil can be used in a number of different ways. It's a very flexible product. It can be used in the manufacture of plastics, foams. It can also be turned into a fuel, and that's what we do with it. We take that soybean oil, we blend it with methanol and a catalyst. We create a methyl ester, which is then blended further with petroleum diesel fuel.
You don't start with soybeans. You start with the oil that comes from another process.
We start with the oil. That's correct.
Okay. So in between the soybean field and the end user, there's a couple of stops. Somewhere it goes and gets made into oil. I think when I had a soybean expert on here once, 80% of a soybean is oil, 70%, something like that?
No, it's mostly meal.
Okay, it's mostly meal. So it's the other way around. So it's correct, mostly meal. Correct.
It's mostly protein and a little bit less is oil. Now, that is one area of research and something that, the scientific community, the agricultural engineers are very interested in. They can modify that genome and make a soybean that has more oil, more protein, less protein. Farmers and agriculture engineers are doing the same thing on the corn, making corn with more oil or less starch or more starch and less oil. Another interesting note, one of the other feed products that we can take is a byproduct of the ethanol production. And within that ethanol facility, when they take and extract the sugars to make the alcohol, they're also producing dry distillers grains. Mm-hmm. There's some oil or lipid in that DDG.
Right.
And they're able to extract that now. And that oil, most of it goes into biodiesel manufacture. Some of it still goes into feed, but most of it's going into biodiesel or renewable diesel.
Yeah. So I know that dry distillers grain was a big thing as part of the rations at these dairies and feed yards. They're taking dry distillers grain, which is a byproduct of the ethanol. Corn is about 80% carbohydrate, if my nutrition classes serve me correctly. So you're using mostly the carbohydrate, but then there's that protein source. But you're saying that then within the dry distillers grain, rather than just feeding it to the cattle, we're actually going to figure out a way to yank out the lipid and use it for what?
That oil can then be used the same as soybean oil or rendered animal fat, and it can be turned into a methyl ester or biodiesel or renewable diesel.
So renewable diesel has a lot of excitement going. And, we here in places like Indiana, where we grow a lot of soybeans, are excited to hear about this future. Is it for real?
It is. Looking 5 years, 10 years down the road, renewable diesel is probably going to be the future of renewable fuel on the diesel side. The reason I say that is if you look at the growth in, the diesel side of the industry, it's coming from conversions of existing petroleum refineries, into renewable diesel production facilities. Rather than, each company is different and they've got their own reasons, but generally speaking, the petroleum refining industry is dying, has been dying for some time. The consumption of petroleum products, refined petroleum products, is decreasing, over the course of time. So,
well, now obviously the push, California's governor says we're going to outlaw gas engines, and then he says mm-hmm. we're going to outlaw diesel engines. So where does all this diesel go if we outlaw these engines? Is that even really right now? It seems economic suicide, because it's not even possible, right? And we don't need to get political here, but it's requiring electric cars when you can't even satisfy the grid right now. I mean, there's a lot of asinine things happening, and that's why we think California is crazy. But in a future with no with battery powered automobiles, is this business, does your business go away?
No, I don't think it does. You're just thinking on the private citizen side, looking commercially. I don't see heavy trucks or railroad locomotives being converted to electric anytime soon. So okay. You've got a legacy fleet of trucks that are hauling products.
It's just a physical impossibility is what you're saying. I mean, that's the point that I would make. The average person is driving around their little Prius. Maybe doesn't fully grasp that, but a damn right. train, you can't have enough battery power to move a locomotive or a freight ship, for God's sakes, right?
Right, right. There's for the foreseeable future, there's going to be a need for distillate type fuel, whether that is from renewable sources or from fossil fuels or petroleum based. That's where the argument truly lies, and how much feedstock exists globally, nationally, regionally, to push that production and to supplant some of that fossil fuel and that petroleum product.
Yeah. So if we somehow have a future without any internal combustion engines, maybe you're talking that's 20 years from now, just because of the physical incapability for that to even happen. So the industry is good. I had a guy on that was talking specifically about renewable fuels, and I said, okay, we got 90 million or so acres of soybeans. Here's how much goes to animal feed, export, whatever. And he said, we'll take it all. I said, what? And he talked about the amount of, is it true that we're under capacity on our production because there's enough demand with this renewable? Because we talk about biodiesel in the old days, but renewable diesel, this is a new thing. And is it going to be the new thing?
I certainly believe it is. Right now, the constraint is just in feedstock quality. Some of these refineries that are being converted now are
feedstock,
very
sensitive. By the way, to a person that's listening to this that's in the livestock industry, you mean feedstock, meaning feeding your plant. You mean the stuff that comes in that feeds your
plant. The raw materials in the case of renewable diesel or biodiesel, I'm talking about the oils, the vegetable oils, the animal fats. That is our raw material. That is our feedstock.
Yep.
So right now, the concern through a lot of the renewable diesel industry or the plant capacities that are being converted right now is they struggle to be able to process the level of metals and the free fatty acids that are, naturally in those oils. So they need to have those removed prior to arrival at the plant for conversion into renewable diesel. So there is, the vegetable oil industry has several projects underway to increase refining, not only crush capacity, but refining capacity. Several of the oil companies have bought and invested in their own pretreatment facilities.
Several of the oil companies, when you say oil company, you mean just people that do what you do, or do you mean like big oil, Exxon?
Big oil, the Exxons, the P66,
Royal Dutch,
the Marathons, absolutely. They've all got a space in the renewable diesel industry right now. They've all got manufacturing facilities that are operational or being converted. And right now, a couple of them are farther down the path or the learning curve than others. And they have additional assets. Marathon, for example, has a couple of facilities where they are buying these unrefined feedstocks, cleaning them up to where they're able to be utilized in their renewable diesel production facilities. And the size of these facilities compared to, we in Erie have a 50 million gallon per year plant. And that was, top five, top 10 in the country for quite a while in terms of biodiesel. Some of these new renewable diesel plants that are coming online are 800 million gallons a year out of one facility.
You said you're 50 million, and a decade ago, you'd have been a top five producer, and you're talking about places that are 13, 12 times what you are, and that's coming online?
Yes. One of the largest renewable diesel producer right now is a joint venture between Darling Ingredients and Valero. It's a plant or a facility company called Diamond Green Diesel. Their large facility is in Louisiana. They're bringing in a second facility online in Texas. And combined, they're going to be a little over a billion gallons of annual production out of one company.
Okay, and in layman's terms, biodiesel versus renewable diesel, the difference is?
Biodiesel versus renewable diesel is the difference is chemistry and the production process. In renewable diesel, essentially, they are hydrotreating. They are taking that oil, that soybean oil, animal fat, used cooking oil, they're putting it under pressure and at very high temperatures. They're cracking it and physically changing the carbon chains of that oil and turning it into a renewable diesel product. Much like you would crack a barrel of petroleum, you'd end up with some gasoline, some diesel fuel, some residual oils, some heavy oils, and then tar or asphalt.
Yeah, I remember I learned about this back when I was like, back in the days when they told us we were going to run out of oil in 40 years. That was 45 years ago that they told me that, and we're mm-hmm. still not out of oil. But anyway, I digress. A cracking tower, yes, where essentially it's the distillates and that kind of thing.
Correct.
We're doing that with we're taking soybean oil mm-hmm. and doing that same thing.
Yep.
And refining it into fuel, and that's renewable.
That is the renewable diesel, correct?
Okay. Then what's biodiesel?
Biodiesel is a process called transesterification, where you take that same feedstock material, that same oil. You introduce an alcohol and a catalyst, and you create a chemical reaction. And then you essentially then are creating what is called a methyl ester, which is the biodiesel, and a byproduct or a co-product, glycerin. So yes, you're breaking the triglyceride with the alcohol, and then you're breaking that into monoglycerides, and then chemically the alcohol molecule is mating to those monoglycerides and converting them to methyl esters.
That's a little bit of chemistry. I want you to explain that. Before you do, I want to talk about explaining some other stuff. I want you to think about this, that revolution in agriculture is going to be about finding information. You know, my friend Rob Syke started a company called AgVisor Pro, and AgVisor Pro was founded on one of his big premises. He says, when you can shorten time and space, there is money to be made, shortening time and space. So that was kind of the concept of AgVisor Pro. You've got questions. You know that farmers spend 19% of their time seeking information. That's a lot of time that could be applied to something more fruitful. So go to AgVisor Pro. It's a revolution in information, if you will. It's an app that you put on your phone. It's a bunch of independent professionals that are out there floating around that have the expertise that you might require. You go to AgVisor Pro, you just put the app on your phone. It's as simple as that. And then you can tap into this network where you get the information that you require. You also could become an expert on AgVisor Pro. Pull up the app, put it on your phone, kick around on it for a while. You'll be happy that you did, and you'll thank me. It's AgVisor Pro. All right. All those things you just said there, Mr. Peterson, were a little complex for somebody that got a C in Purdue in chemistry 112. So help me out here. On the biodiesel, our process is different. You told me it was more akin to refining for renewable diesel. Mm-hmm. What you guys do is not a refining process.
That's correct. We are utilizing chemistry and physics in our process. We're creating a chemical reaction. You can do this. This is very simple. You can do this actually in your own kitchen. You can take a container of soybean oil, canola oil, corn oil that you buy in the grocery store. Introduce some alcohol to it. Now you're going to have a hard time. You're most likely looking at like a grain alcohol or a very high alcohol content product. Mm-hmm. Out of the liquor store, introduce those two in a glass beaker. Over the course of time, you're going to start to see the glycerin molecules drop out. They're heavier, so they'll go to the bottom. You'll have a layer of glycerin across the bottom of the container, mm-hmm. and then the biodiesel will end up on the top. So like I said, you can do this. It's very simple chemistry. The art is in the execution and doing this at a commercial scale and producing quality that's able to go into the fuel stream.
Got it. So your stuff comes there at your facility. What are you bringing in and turning into biodiesel?
We have done a lot of research over the course of time in terms of blending. We're able to, because of our multi-feedstock capabilities, we're able to take a multitude of products. So we're buying what's most economical on the market on a daily basis. That could be rendered animal fats from a pork processing plant, a beef processing plant, a little bit of poultry fat. We use cooking oil collected out of restaurants, virgin vegetable oils, soy and canola. With our facility in Erie, we're close enough to the Canadian border where there are some canola processing plants where from time to time, it's made economic sense to touch canola oil. So any number of products are coming into our plant on a daily basis.
But they are oils when they come in.
Correct. They're oil. They're oils. Now,
several years ago, I spoke for National Renderers Association. That's the other NRA. Yep. And I learned a little bit about this industry so I could actually be knowledgeable enough to talk to them. And most people don't even think about that, everything that gets slaughtered into meat, there's a whole bunch of stuff that then gets rendered and made into other stuff. And so the fats and the tallow and all that kind of stuff gets cooked into an oil. When it comes to your place, it's an oil, but it don't matter to you. I mean, as long as it comes in as an oil, you guys can make it work.
Correct. That's an oversimplification, but yes, it is accurate.
Did you just call me simple?
No. I did not.
I think you have to take the complex and make it simple so that way it's understandable for everybody. So this stuff that comes in, it don't matter what it comes in as and what form, you do the same thing to it?
For the most part, yes. It's now the trickery is in what we call pretreatment. And what we do is we remove excess free fatty acids. We remove some of the metals, some of the other contaminants that don't generally convert into methyl ester or into fuel. So we'll process, we'll clean up those oils, you know, in one building or in one part of the plant. And then when that is done, we'll process them over into the, you know, the actual biodiesel side of the facility. So we handle each of those different types of feedstock a little bit differently in terms of temperatures, chemical addition, you know, the amount of water that's introduced, you know, to help remove those metals and other contaminants. So there's a little bit of difference on the pretreatment side. And then from the, you know, the biodiesel reaction, that side is pretty similar no matter what we're using as a raw material.
This conference I'm going to be speaking at on October 13th in Savannah, it's a huge association. And I can see companies like you being there, fats and oils are what you take and turn into something. Who else is going to be at this kind of thing? What, tell me about a membership of an organization. You're pretty active in the association.
Sure.
This is an entire industry that most people don't think about. Just like I talked about renders, most people eat steak and they don't realize, the cow that came off of, the part that wasn't meat, it got used also. The bones got made into something, the tallow, the hide, all that stuff. So there's a whole bunch of stuff out here where they're using fats and oils. You obviously think of, okay, go to the store and buy you some Wesson oil, and it might be made out of, I think it's made out of corn oil, you know, Mazola, whatever, canola oil, sunflower oil. There's that. But then the stuff that's for human consumption, there's a bunch of it that doesn't directly go into a bottle that we buy at the Kroger, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From the vegetable oil side, you know, some of it goes into, gets sold to restaurants, McDonald's, fries, you know, all of their fried products in soybean oil or vegetable oils. So a lot of it is used primarily for cooking. It gets used, you know, as an ingredient in the baking industry. You know, your donuts, your cookies, that you know, those types of baked products, you know, contain vegetable oils.
Yeah. So some process, some bakery somewhere is bringing in soybean oil or whatever, canola oil, whatever it should be, by the tanker load.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we see a lot of it. You know, we buy product from potato chip factories. You know, once they're done cooking the chips, they cycle their oil out every so often. We'll buy the used cooking oil from the potato chip factories. There's a lot of places.
That's a place we talked about before we hit record. And I want you to explain this side of the industry also. A huge potato chip factory is going to have oil in large quantities. They can then have somebody that sits at their computer and sells their used oil to somebody like you.
Absolutely.
But you can see where that's an actual industry of like, hey, they just know that there's oil brokers, whatever. But then the Mexican restaurant down here that is owned, but you know, by just a man and his wife, they don't have the resources and they don't have a 8,500 gallon tanker truck of this to get rid of every, you know, 10 days. They've got a couple of fryers. What's happening with that space? Because you told me that's actually turned into a business. It used to not
that,
be.
That is the used cooking oil collection business over the last 10 years has turned into a very complex multi-billion dollar industry, and it's becoming global. It used to be back when I was young, you know, I used to work in restaurants, you know, in high school, and I worked at McDonald's, and you used to pay, and a lot of that used cooking oil would end up in a landfill and you'd pay to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, now these collectors are actually paying the restaurant owners to be able to pick up that oil, and they're aggregating it from, you know, a multitude of restaurants, taking it back into a central processing facility. They're boiling out the excess water, they're filtering out the, you know, the food particles and other solids that are in it, and they're selling it off to feed mills, they're selling it off to renewable diesel and biodiesel producers
like you,
like me.
There's a middle step, but it's gotten, as you said, that thing has matured, and it sounds
absolutely
like better, that instead of just going out and dumping it down the drain or whatever, now it's you can actually, instead of paying to get rid of it, you get paid, and then you give them whatever it is, your 20 gallons
correct
of fry oil or whatever.
And, you know, it's gotten to the point now where, you know, a lot of the food suppliers like a Sysco or a US Foods type of company, they are building into their agreements, hey, we'll sell you this clean 5 gallon bucket of fryer oil, but we reserve the right to come and get the used gallon or the used bucket of oil when you're done with it.
Yeah.
So the, you know, even the food service companies are getting involved.
Sure,
you know,
makes sense.
In the collection of this oil.
So I asked you about the people that are in the members of this. Continue down that road, because
sure, it's a very you know, wide spectrum of people that are members and will attend. And we've got you know, members who are ocean going vessel brokers. We have members who are you know, that work with the railroads and trucking companies. We have members who are, you know, work for large global multinational, you know, agricultural companies like an ADM or a Cargill.
I want to talk to you about the multinational aspect of this. When the Russia invaded Ukraine there in February, March of this year, a lot of folks, you know, asked me, and I said, hey, I'm not a global markets expert on commodities. I keep up, but that's not my expertise. But I can tell you this, and I talked about the oil. Ukraine makes like 70% of the, maybe the world, but certainly the region's sunflower exports. And people are like, what the, what? And again, the average person thinks, well, sunflowers, you mean like, you know, you eat them when you're in a ball game? Like, yeah, that's like this much of sunflower production. Almost all sunflowers end up as oil. And that's the, I believe, one of the preferred oils in that area because they can grow it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, I believe the number is more like 80%. Russia and Ukraine are responsible for 80% of the global sunflower oil supply, which of the total vegetable oils, it's a small percentage.
Yeah, however, by order, you correct me here, but I'm guessing it's just like everything. Corn and then soybean are the two biggest, and then probably canola oil is our number
three. Canola, rapeseed, palm oil is a huge one.
Not here, but certainly in climatological areas where they don't grow corn and soybeans, but they can grow the hell out of palm trees.
Well, right? You'd be surprised how much palm oil makes its way to the U.S., mostly going into the food service. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of palm oil because of its relative expense or inexpense compared to a canola or a soy. There is a lot of palm oil that is consumed in the U.S.
Right. So back to our point, sunflower oil is not the number one or two, probably not even three. Is it corn first or is it soybean first?
I believe it's soybean first and then to a lesser extent, corn and you know, rapeseed, and canola, rapeseed.
Well, my listeners know that rapeseed is canola and canola is rapeseed. By the way, I wrote about it in my book. Professors at Western Province Universities in Canada back in the 70s were pioneering this to make the rapeseed a more dominant crop. It fits their climate. And also, it's got a really good oil, except that it was high in acid. So when they invented this, they were able to make it a low acidic oil. And they kept breeding through genetics and all that to make a viable crop out of it. And then somebody said, yeah, we can't sell rapeseed. So hence canola, Canadian oil, low acid. That's how it got its name. Canadian oil, low acid. Anyway, boring you there. I know, Chris. Okay.
No.
So that sunflower thing, did you feel the thing with the Russia Ukraine situation and the sunflower oil market being impacted? It was my understanding, like in Holland, Western Europe, there were shortages of, you went to the grocery store and there wasn't no vegetable oil on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And it was like, how the hell am I going to go home and cook my stir fry or, you know, bake cookies? I need oil. And there was none there.
Absolutely. It's a rush. When something like that happens, obviously if it would happen to soybean oil, there's, you know, much more pain felt and it's more widespread. But like, you know, in the example that you pointed out, there's a rush, you know, then to find alternatives. So if the sunflower oil isn't in a certain place, what can we use instead of it? And how do we get it here? And, you know, doing that in a quick fashion isn't easy. So you're going to see, and you did see, you know, some outages. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure the people that were responsible for the sunflower supply chain were scrambling to find, you know, anything else that they could find, you know, whether it be palm oil, soybean oil, you know, find a suitable replacement. And it just took time to get that, you know, into place.
Interesting. What question did I not ask you? What thing do you know that nobody else does that's outside of the fats and oils industry? What thing is that like that if you were saying here's something probably nobody knows, boom, you got something like that for me?
You know, not really. I think just behind the scenes, the average consumer doesn't think when they pick up, you know, a package of pork chops to go home and make for dinner, how did it get there? And the, you know, the process from, you know, a pig squealing, you know, on a farm to, you know, those pork chops getting ready to hit to the grill, you know, and what happens in between is quite fascinating. And, you know, I've been doing this for 16 or 17 years now, and it's kind of second nature, but it was a big surprise to see how these things worked and how developed that industry truly is and how much science goes into that.
And then, you know, the Green Crusaders would like us to never have fossil fuels, but then we know that that's just, it's just not physically capable of getting away from those kinds of engines. And we talked about for freight, but also the Green Crusaders, some of them are of the vegan crowd, and they have this whole thing that we're going to save the earth if we stop eating livestock. I'm like, but we don't stop eating. We still, everything we still grow has to have an impact. And right. I think that's, you know, kind of right in your alley also. Whether you bring in rendered pork fat and turn it into something or canola oil, it's all still a food product and byproducts, et cetera, it's still kind of all a big chain.
It is. And another thing that I don't want to start the food versus fuel argument here, but a lot of what we do provides value to the farmer and the ag industry. We are taking what used to be a waste product, we're providing value, you know, back to the farmer, you know, for that. And we're making the ultimate product, which in the fact of raising livestock is the protein. Mm-hmm. We're making the protein cheaper by providing more net back, you know, on the rendered fats and you know, what we're doing with the carcasses.
Yeah. And again, that all by taking some, you know, there was a time, I'm not too far from Gas City, Indiana. There was a time when they used to dig down to try and get to the oil, and they would burn up the natural gas because it was above it, right? And mm-hmm. then they said, wait a minute, maybe we can use this stuff. It's kind of a similar thing you're talking about. We're discovering values. I had the ethanol guy on, Jeff Cooper, and talking about ethanol 6 or 12 months ago. We talked about carbon dioxide. If the ethanol plants aren't going, one of their big byproducts is carbon dioxide. And people are like, well, I thought carbon dioxide was bad. Well, not when you are in the medical industry. The welding and metals uses carbon dioxide. Every lab uses carbon dioxide, a bunch of hospital usage, and obviously beverages. They sell CO2 as a byproduct to put it in your beer or your pop. I'm going to be there October 13th at your event in Savannah. I appreciate you being on here. You got anything on the way out the door to wrap up that point? Because I know I interrupted you.
No, just keeping an eye to the weather, you know, fingers crossed that everything is good. You know, right now we're really looking forward to the event in Savannah. It's our first time there. Obviously with, you know, the event being sold out, the response has been good. We're hopeful that, everybody gets there safely and has a good time.
Well, what's interesting is I speak about the business of agriculture, hence this podcast right here. There's a lot of folks that wouldn't think that a guy in your situation, you're obviously probably have some kind of an engineering or chemistry background based on your fluent ability to speak about it. And there's some people that wouldn't think that you're in the ag industry. But if you were at a cocktail party, they said, what industry do you work in? You would probably say, I work in agriculture, because you do.
Well, believe it or not, I'm a degreed accountant.
Well, you roll words like glycol ethylenes off your tongue pretty handily for an accountant.
Well, I've been doing it for a long time, so it's a learned behavior.
But do you think that you're, do you tell people you work in agriculture?
I tell people I work in agriculture. I work in the fuels industry. They're both kind of interchangeable.
I think that they are. Thanks for being on here. His name's Chris Peterson. If you want to learn more about their company and what they do, it's called Hero BX. Hero like you are my hero, BX.com. I'm Damian Mason. This is, by the way, thank you, Chris, for being on here.
My pleasure.
See you in less than 2 weeks. This is The Business of Agriculture with me, Damian Mason. Till next time. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.